Sages Stories.
Welcome to today's episode of Sages Stories, the official podcast of Sages, the Society of American Gastrointestinal and Endoscopic Surgeons. Please make sure to hit the like button and subscribe so you can stay up to date with our most recent episode and enjoy the show.
Welcome back for episode 22 of Sages Stories, where we shine the light on some of Sages' most impactful leaders. I'm still your co-host, Dr. Kevin Ohayek from Cleveland, Ohio.
I mean, it's a new year, but I'm still here as well, Kevin. I'm your co-host, whether you like it or not. I'm coming from Los Angeles, California. My name is Dr. Shirin Tofai, and I know a lot of you were sweating like we were, that our contracts at Sages Stories would be over, would be kicked out or something. They need newer, younger, cuter co-hosts, but you know, we were renewed for 2024, so here we are.
And that was close. It was in the 11th hour, and I know my agent was a bit aggressive, but I'm glad we could keep the team together, and I hope we make Sages proud as we move into the fourth calendar year of the podcast. It's just kind of crazy to think about.
That's
editor's note. There was no one else who wanted to do it.
That's because of my help. My Hollywood agent really
definitely kept us going.
They know what they're doing. Okay, well, to keep this great year going after the last episode, which I thought was really great, we are thrilled to have Dr. Christopher Schlachta. He is the current president-elect of Sages and is today's guest. As an introduction, Dr. Schlachta received his medical degree from McGill University in Montreal. I almost went there, by the way. We could have been classmates. In 1990, after which he completed general surgery training at the University of Western Ontario, followed by a fellowship in advanced minimally invasive surgery at the Wellesley Hospital at the University of Toronto. Today, Dr. Schlachta wears many professional hats at his institution. First, he is a professor of the Department of Surgery and the Department of Oncology at the Schulich School of Medicine and Dentistry at Western University. He is also chief of surgery at the University Hospital site, London Health Sciences Center in Ontario, Canada. Two additional hats, because, you know, lots of hats here, include being medical director of CSTAR, which stands for the Canadian Surgical Technologies and Advanced Robotics, and the program director of the Advanced GI and Minimally Invasive Surgery Fellowship, also at London Health Sciences Center in London, Ontario. Like many of our guests, his list of honors and awards, several pages long, not as long as Kevin and mine. Ours are very short, much longer than Kevin and mine's. Ours are very short.
And we when you put ours together, we still don't quite get there.
This is true. And we will certainly dive into some of these great accomplishments during the show. Hopefully we can learn something out of it. So we're very privileged to have you. I'm calling you Chris. Is that okay?
That is absolutely okay, and I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me.
Perfect.
Yeah, I'm really glad we finally pinned you down, and I know it's a late hour for those of us on the Eastern Standard Time, but we want to thank you in advance for making this work. Yes. We always like to start just with letting our guests do a little free form. Tell us a little bit about yourself with answers to a few questions like, where did you grow up? What were some key turning points along your journey? And will the U.S. ever be as good as Canada in hockey, for example?
We'll start with the last one. The answer to that is not a chance. So I moved around a lot as a kid. I was born in Montreal. So I'm a Montrealer by birth. Je viens de Montréal. And I still identify that as being home. But we moved around a lot. And not because of... People say, was your father in the military or something? It was, I think he just couldn't decide what he wanted to do for a living. So moved from Montreal to Toronto, from Toronto to St. Louis, Missouri for a while when I was very young. Lived in Westport, Connecticut for a while when I was young, I think until about grade three, at which point we moved back to Montreal again, which was a remarkable transition because, you know, the formative years of my life were playing Little League baseball and not hockey, like most Canadians. And I remember learning about the Minutemen and the Redcoats. And then I came back to Canada and had to learn that, wait a minute, the bad guys were the loyalists. And
Oh man.
wait
Quite
a minute,
confusing.
this song, God Save the Queen, sounds exactly like My Country 'Tis of Thee. Like I was having
Yeah.
a hard struggle deciding
So
which was
weird,
the
right?
side to be on. So, but yeah, and then settled back in Canada after that and moved, even in Canada, moved around a lot. I think between grade three and high school, I went to a different school every year. So you
Oh,
learn how to
wow.
make friends quickly and dispose of old friends, I suppose, as
Pretty
it goes on.
disruptive in these years. I mean that's yeah. How'd that happen that you were in new school every year?
A lot of moving around. So, I'm fairly certain it wasn't the schools requesting that I be excused. I think it was my parents moving around and finally settling into a house with a family and so on, but you never know.
Quick question about that. Did you feel that that changed how you interact with people? Because I have a friend that did that, and she said she felt like she only had a year to tell everyone who she was. So like she would just tell everything about her life to people the minute she met them, kind of being afraid that they're going to be like gone and she'll be at a different school again. No, was that just
That's the really interesting thought because I fully recognize that I'm one of those individuals that when you ask me what time it is, I set about explaining to you how to build a clock or how to make a watch, right? So, because I feel the need to impart that knowledge to you, right?
Oh my God, yeah.
But they say if you build a man a fire, he'll be warm for a day, and if you set him on fire, he'll be warm for the rest of his life. So
That's actually
that's
wow. I mean, that is a true statement that
I not heard that version.
I haven't either. That's a bit of a snarky spin. I was waiting for the other version, but I love
And
it.
double fishing,
is it
gotcha.
your snarkiness that made you attracted to surgery?
No, surgery was I was very interested in medicine from a young I went into high school already knowing that I wanted to be a doctor. And there no I have no family history of that. My grandfather, who immigrated to Canada in the 1920s, was a tailor, and the family profession was being tailor. So we like to talk about carrying on with sewing,
Yeah, sure.
but
Work.
my father was the first member of my family on either side to go to university, and he got a bachelor's degree. So I was the first doctor in the family, if you will. And I decided early I was going to be a doctor. I don't remember precisely why. I think living in Montreal and knowing about McGill and made me say, yeah, I want to be a doctor. So, but then in medical school, I went to medical school very excited about things like the Human Genome Project was just underway. I had done some genetic research, as part of my undergrad. And I went to medical school planning on being an MD, PhD, egghead, gene therapy researcher, or something like that. And my very early exposure in medical school was that the coolest kids in town were the surgeons. And I needed to be cool.
Badness. So
I guess some things are timeless. The fact that that's still true today. We're not biased at all in that
it's an
regard.
international law, absolutely.
The only thing cooler than being a surgeon is being a sage's surgeon.
That's right. That's right. Did
That's
you have any early mentors that kind of guided you as you changed your path to surgery?
Yeah, it's a good question. There were a few. Probably the most interesting one in the early days, because when I was in, I think it was first or second year medical school, they try to integrate you to the hospital. We had a program called Introduction to the Patient. It was the first ITP acronym that I learned, and then other crushing versions of that came later on. But when I would go to the operating room and watch surgery, we got to do that a few times. We saw a lot of what we all remember historically as being some sort of bad behavior, a lot of very aggressive surgeons, a lot of intimidation going on, throwing of instruments, this all the historical stuff that people hear about that hopefully doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah,
And
hopefully.
I remember one day getting a chance to go to the endoscopy suite and see them doing this cool flexible endoscopy thing, which reminded me of a National Geographic episode I'd once seen on TV when I was a, a kid. And the endoscopist who was scoping that day was apparently a surgeon, but didn't behave like a surgeon at all. They were kind, they were answering questions, they were engaging with me, and I was like, whoa, who is this person? That person was Jerry Fried, who we all
Oh,
know really well. So
that's
that was my first
yes.
introduction to a surgeon who
Wow.
was a real human being. So
Wow. That's a great story.
those of you listening, we did interview Jerry Fried, and he's, among our amazing Sage's family.
Yeah,
Very
that's
influential
amazing.
Canadian member.
So was that kind of the moment then that you sort of think led you to kind of go down that path, or you were still thinking the genome project before that, and then, or it was sort of.
I, as much as I would like to give Jerry credit for that, no, I don't think so. I truly do think that, I just, as I was working my way through medical school, just decided that, that surgery was really like the cool thing to do. Everybody, you write a letter, why do I want to be a surgeon? Everybody writes about how they're good with their hands and so on. I've always been sort of a dexterous sort of individual, but to be perfectly, to be perfectly honest with you, I just wanted to be cool. I just wanted to be a member of that club. They just seemed like such an interesting group of people. And you fix people. You're not prescribing medications and following up in, 2 months to see if their blood pressures come down. You fix them.
Yeah.
So I really like that aspect of it. So.
And how did your clinical practice evolve throughout the years? Like when you first started versus the kind of operations and work that you do in a typical week now?
Well, it's changed a lot over the years. So the first thing is, when I graduated from my general surgery training, I, went and did a fellowship, and I wanted to, I, so when I was an intern at the Toronto General Hospital, I was struggling with deciding what I wanted to be in med school. I wanted to be a neurosurgeon. I wanted to be a brain surgeon, neurosurgeon. I want to say I was a brain surgeon. I'm not sure I wanted to be one. And I did an elective in neurosurgery and very quickly discovered that I didn't want to be one. Decided that I was interested in orthopedic surgery. Then I went through a phase of wanting to be a plastic surgeon and do hand surgery. And then one day, as an intern at the Toronto General Hospital, I went to the operating room, and two of our senior hepatobiliary surgeons, Bryce Taylor and Paul Gregg were their names, very accomplished and well known in the University of Toronto. They were operating on a patient's gallbladder, and the lights were out. And there was like 30 people in the room, and I got to hold the camera for them. And I remember at one point
Wow.
they were taking an instrument out and putting an instrument back in again. And so I just instinctively pulled the camera back to give them the wide angle view and then zoomed the camera back in again. And I remember Bryce looking at Paul saying, "Did you see what he just did there? We should write a paper on that." Because it was the very early, and that was an epiphany, not that act, but that day I said, "Wow." Once again, perhaps there's some personal insecurity here, but motivated by wanting to be the cool kid, I said, I'm going to do laparoscopy. This is what I got to do, is be a laparoscopic surgeon.
But it's
And
also
that led to my fellowship, and that led to my early practice.
the instinct. I don't know about you guys, but the residents we have do so much robotic surgery, they forgot the art of like holding a camera laparoscopically.
Yeah, that's for sure.
We're gonna touch on that in a second too, because I notice robotic is something that you've definitely gone down and continued to investigate. But I have a quick question about your evolution. You've done a lot, and you've definitely had a broad exposure to different operations. I always like to know what a surgeon's favorite operation is. So what's your favorite operation?
So, at the risk of telling you how to build a watch, right now I would say my favorite operation that I do is the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass.
Okay.
But I got to tell you, prior to that, I would say that my original favorite operation was a laparoscopic donor nephrectomy.
Okay.
That's very early in my career,
For
besides,
transplant as a
yeah,
donor.
for transplant. Yeah, circa 1999, I think. My mentors were Eric Poulin, the late Eric Poulin, after which there is a named lecture at the Canadian Surgery Forum every year, and Joe Mamazza, who's still working in Ottawa, if I'm correct. They decided that we needed to do this donor nephrectomy thing. They were very avant-garde, minimally invasive surgeons. They were on the leading edge of everything in the 1990s. And so we got to do this donor nephrectomy. And so Joe started the program and I was the tag along. But one of the things I liked about that operation was two things. One was it was such elegant surgery. It was an operation that you could aspire to do it perfectly. You know, you go to do a, it wasn't an operation that was messy. It was a surgery that I wanted to be able to say, look, that was, I did the perfect nephrectomy. And it was also, I'm sorry, but it was also, we did them typically on a morning when the residents were off at teaching. So it was like the only surgery I got to do myself. So, I mean, that made it a favorite. But the reason why I love the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass now is because it's another operation. The way we do it is with a lot of free needle suturing. Mm-hmm. And we teach our fellows and our residents. We pride ourselves on graduating residents and fellows that can sew laparoscopically. And that's an operation that I'm still striving to do the perfect bypass. So
that's the Taylor root in you.
That must be.
Well, so thank you for that answer, because Kevin and I had a bet as to what your answer would be. And he said it was going to be splenectomy. So
I thought it was going to be splenectomy, given how much you've written about and all the work you've done. And so, I mean, we don't often go clinically on this, but I think we can do that. And, we were going to ask when you consider splenic artery embolization prior to splenectomy these days. What's changed in splenectomy?
Well, I don't do as much anymore, but that was all the influence of my mentors in the early days. But, the splenic artery embolization was the invention of Poulin and Mamatsa. And, that was in the very early days when we were fearful about bleeding, right? And the fear about loss of control. And, I think we learned in the early days, they learned in the early days that the embolization caused the patient so much pain, it actually prolonged their hospital stay. So certainly we've backed away from that now. Even if I do a giant spleen now, I don't, it's been decades since I've embolized somebody preoperative.
Did you ever read the article by Dr. Leon Morgenstern? He was a big spleen guy, former chairman at my hospital, Cedars-Sinai, called the Shah's Spleen. Did you ever read that article?
I'm embarrassed to say I have not.
I need to read
it's a
that.
Historic one about the Shah and his spleen and why he died and all that of Iran. So it's kind of a cool, if you like the spleen, it's kind of a cool story.
I would love to read that.
Yeah, I'll email it to you. It's pretty cool. Okay, so Kevin, you owe me dinner at
Cleveland. Well, wait a minute. What did you predict?
Yeah, what did you predict, Sharon?
No, I didn't predict anything. I was
So I still owe her dinner. See that?
Spleen wasn't a bad guess. I mean, that's an operation that you can also strive to do perfectly, right?
I mean, it's very close to a donor nephrectomy in many respects. I mean, it's right there. So
I've taken out a spleen and said, whoops, that's not going to do.
The answer to all my questions is always
a hernia.
My answer is always hernia.
Yeah, robotic hernia. She thought you were going to say robotic inguinal hernia is what she was going to say.
My world is a little bit colored that way. Okay, another thing I noticed from your CV, Chris, was that your obvious interest in robotic surgery, we kind of talked about that. So, like I mentioned earlier, we're doing so much robotic surgery that I feel that since I do a lot of laparoscopy still, I kind of like try and keep it true. I'm kind of like OG. So the residents don't know how to handle the camera, like a 30-degree scope to them is like, I have to teach them like I would teach a medical student sometimes. What's your take on that? What do you think about the future of training residents? Are you worried about resource limited environments? I mean,
so you guys need to have a hand signal or something to tell me when to stop talking, right? Because all of these questions
you've been good. These are good length.
The first thing I will say is the whole fear about lost skills, right? I mean, I remember in my Toronto days, which is going back some time when I was at St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto, I remember residents would when they heard we were going to be doing an open cholecystectomy, would line up to get involved in the case because they wanted to see an open cholecystectomy. And
Oh.
people would say, wow, you're doing them all laparoscopically now. How is a resident ever going to do an open chole when the time comes? And my response to that is always, wow, how is somebody ever going to ride a horse? We've been driving cars for so many years. You know, I mean, so.
I don't know how to ride a horse.
Yeah, well, exactly, because we just don't do that anymore. But, you know, the original contraindications, relative contraindications of cholecystectomy were acute cholecystitis, obesity, you know, all the things that we operate on laparoscopically now.
Yeah, true.
So the question, it's an interesting concept about potential loss of skills. We don't do that much robotic surgery now. It's funny because we can talk about this later if you want to, but part of the reason I left Toronto and moved to London was for robotic surgery and C-STAR and so on. And I wanted to get on the robotic bandwagon almost 20 years ago. And I've backed off lately, part of it, well, not lately, in the last decade or so, because of the need to teach our residents how to operate laparoscopically.
Mm.
In Canada, there's not as much availability of the of robotics. I think we're starting to see a significant uptake now. But I actually backed off a lot because I had to make a decision. Do I want to be, you know, 2005 is when I started doing robotic surgery. So, and at the time to learn how to do robotic surgery, I had to go and watch a urologist doing surgery. There weren't that many people who were, you know, doing a lot of robotic general surgery. And then obviously things have flowed significantly in the last few years. But I had to back off of that and say, well, we got to teach our residents how to operate laparoscopically because there weren't enough champions for that to train them. But I will say one interesting thing. When we interview our fellows for a fellowship now, we interview a Canadian applicant. They want to know how much console time they're going to get and how much robotic training they're going to get because they're really excited about wanting to learn how to use the robot. And when we interview our American applicants for our fellowship, they all want to know how much laparoscopic surgery training they're going to get and are we going to teach them how to suture laparoscopically. Wow. So it's an interesting, completely opposite perspective.
How do you answer the
yeah. candidates?
We tell them they're going to get exposure to both. I promise them that they're going to know how to use the robot when they finish their fellowship, and I promise them they're going to be able to sew. One of my favorite lines is to tell our fellows that the current measure, and I hope I'm not offending anybody now, the current measure of a skilled laparoscopic surgeon is their ability to suture with a free needle.
Yeah,
that to me is the metric.
For
and,
sure.
And I tell them, you're going to be a suturing wizard when you're finished, and you may want to use a robot, and we can talk about that. I think that's the future, but we're going to make sure you can do it laparoscopically first.
Yeah, that's where the gastric bypass comes into place.
Yeah.
Lots of suturing, you know, laparoscopically.
Well, that's great that you kind of have that perspective on both sides of the border. And certainly you've been very involved in societies, both in Canada and now with the Sages being the president, and obviously spent time growing up here a little bit. So as you take on the role of the president-elect, and we'll talk a little bit more about that as well later, but what are some of the issues that exist, you know, for both countries, and then maybe some that are unique? You mentioned one about access to robot, but some other issues that are maybe different between the two countries.
Well, I think the most obvious answer, first of all, is we share a lot of commonalities, right? And we share a lot of concerns about diversity and equity, inclusion. The green initiative that Pat Zilla has really thrust us into this year is something that we share across the border quite a bit. It's interesting. I was having a conversation with Eric Wilson recently, who does a brilliant job of the SDTS symposium as a part of our innovation weekend. And he was asking me what my favorite chokar was. I hope I didn't just ruin part of his program. I said, I like to use this reusable trocar. And
nice.
Being lauded for using reusable trocars because we're not wasting all that plastic. And it's so, I had to say, well, I mean, I'm thrilled that people want to apply that perspective, but the reality is that we're cheap. We can't afford to keep using disposable trocars. So we've been using reusable trocars forever, just simply from a financial perspective. So healthcare resources is an issue on both sides of the border. Surgical wait lists are an issue on both sides of the border. The introduction of technology is something that's been quite a bit harder on the Canadian front than on the American side. You guys are driven by different factors in your healthcare system, and the widespread adoption of robotics. I think there's a lot that's going to be said about that someday, about how that advanced at the accelerated pace that it has. It has advanced much more slowly in Canada, but we are catching up. So I think those are probably some of the issues.
Pretty impressive that robotic technology can expand so quickly, even in like a socialist healthcare system. It's so expensive
Yeah, we
and
like to.
resource
I'm
heavy.
sorry. Finish your point. Yeah, I could just jumped in there with enthusiasm. Go ahead.
No, I mean I'm a big fan of robotic surgery, but I feel like there's areas where it's superior, and so that's when I use it. But if it's not superior necessarily, I like laparoscopy. It's so beautiful and delicate, and the scars are smaller, and you can kind of hide them in nicer places. And I feel like that art, at least in the US, we're losing the art of laparoscopy a little bit.
I would say I've always been. I mean, when I moved to London to get on the robotic bandwagon, we had the second Da Vinci in Canada. We had lost out by 3 months. The first one was bought at the Hôpital Sacré-Cœur in Montreal, and then we were the second ones in Canada to get a Da Vinci, and then we were the third ones to get a Da Vinci. So there was a period of time when two of Canada's three Da Vincis were in London, Ontario, and affiliated with SeaStar and so on. Yeah, but I think we've always been very critical about show me the evidence. Is this better than laparoscopy? And there were some clear procedures in the early days that, in my mind, when people were still saying robots too expensive, I was saying yes, but like I used to do a lot of rectal cancer surgery, laparoscopic TME, and so on. And I would tell you, I would never do that laparoscopically now if I could have access to a robot, for example. So there's a bunch of operations. We did a whole series of choledochotomy and common bile duct expirations for patients who had stones that were refractory to ERCP extraction and
Yeah, I
stones
saw
that would
that.
not have been amenable to transcystic. I mean, we're talking impacted stones. And
Yeah, I
we did
saw
a
that.
bunch of those with the robot. And it's a beautiful technology, uni-quadrant,
Yeah.
multi-million-dollar sewing machine. It was like perfect, perfect technology for that application as well. So.
Yeah, that's a great, that was a, I saw that on your CV that you'd looked at that, and that was over a decade ago.
You're also part of the college's, the American College of Surgeons Surgical Simulation Education Certification Advisory Committee. I had that for many years. I thought it was really fun going to different places and certifying them as a academic educational institute. But how do you think that's changed? What's the role of SAGES in doing any of that as opposed to the college? And how you've probably seen the impact of hands-on simulation, how it's evolved. How do you think it's going to kind of continue to advance surgical education in the future?
Yeah. So, how much time do we have? So I was very fortunate to be involved with the Surgical Skills Lab at Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto back in the early days when Richard Resnick was the chairman in Toronto and obviously an icon in the simulation world. That was at a time when the simulation centers were Surgical Skills Lab and Task Trainer, and we're trying to teach people how to suture laparoscopically and do. What was it? Ro Cobra rope and bean drop and all these early skills pre-FLS.
Yes.
Now, SeaStar was a very, was founded as a research institute, and we opened up this whole surgical skills arm, which has really grown, and we're now a full service simulation center that does all kinds of interprofessional training and everything else. So, I think we have been waiting for the day when. Mentors, instructors would have the intestinal fortitude to tell a trainee that you can't touch a patient until you have reached a certain level of competency in the simulation lab. I think we're starting to see some variable adoption of that, but I think we're going to see, as we start moving forward now in the world of mediated reality, and we've got augmented reality. I think the Apple Vision Pro, I have no proprietary interests or shares or anything, but I think this, if that technology takes off in the way that it should, I think that's going to have a profound impact in the augmented reality world, and all of the potential that that brings with being able to train residents in increasingly high fidelity situations. So I the short answer to your question is I think we're going to see a bigger and bigger role for simulation going forward. And Sages has been there since the beginning. I mean, you look at FLS and FES and Fuse and all of these fundamental programs. Sages took the concerns about safe COLI very seriously and really established themselves, ourselves. Let's give the people credit that's due, established themselves as global leaders in the safe introduction of laparoscopic surgery and now surgical technology.
In your work with this committee, I'm sure the topic of standardization has come up. What are some, quick hitters for improving standardization of simulation programs? Because I think that's probably one of the areas that is just challenging given the different locations, the different resources available. I mean, you go to a place like University of Michigan and it's so robust, the curriculum and the, the program, and then, you have a smaller program that just doesn't have the manpower or the, the equipment to do it. How do you move the needle?
Well, I'll pretend to have some expertise, which I don't, but since you're asking me the question, I would say the most important thing is having committed individuals that are enthusiastic about training and doing the best with the facilities that they have. We've gone through accreditation. We're an AEI, Accredited Education Institute of the American College. Our Sim Center is accredited by the Royal College in Canada as well. And I got to tell you, every time you go through one of these accreditations, it's such a onerous process, and you look at the standards they're asking you to address, and you're like, how can I possibly know what my unrecognized needs are if I can't recognize them? Like, you're just pulling your hair out going, how am I going to deal? But and there's a fair bit of cursing and swearing and vowing to never talk to these people again, as you're working your way through the process. But you come out at the end of it with a much better program. Like, it's incredible how much you actually learn about developing and making a much better program. But it all comes down to having enthusiastic educators. I mean, there's no way. I mean, who knows? We'll see what AI does. But as it stands right now, the fundamental that every simulation program needs is to have somebody who enjoys teaching and wants to be the person that puts that curriculum together and engages with the program. So.
I have a question about that. Who pays for the surgical educators? Is that funding always readily available? Because in the US, it's very hard to get funding for a non-clinical person, right? Someone who teaches all the time. Is that a similar challenge in Canada?
Yeah, no, in Canada, everybody gets a basic guaranteed income. And so, no, that's a joke. No, that's an ongoing challenge for that's an ongoing challenge for every program is how do you buy your time? And I don't think our challenges are any different than yours if we're going to really do an us versus them on this topic. It's, that's why you need somebody who's enthusiastic and committed because they do what they love. If you do what you love, you never work a day in your life. Wasn't that a Confucius thing? So, anyways.
Well, we forgot to ask you, how did you even get involved with Sage? Did someone introduce you to become a member? How did that happen?
When I was a resident in 1992, one of my mentors at the time, Marie Girardi, was somebody who was very actively involved in teaching lab coli across the country. There was a roving band of surgeons that traveled from coast to coast, doing pig labs and so on, the way lab coli was introduced around the world, and they had the Canadian contingent. Marie Girardi was one of those people, and he handed me a CD-ROM one day. I have to tell the Utes what a CD-ROM is, but he handed me a CD-ROM and I put it in the computer, and it was the Sages program from 92. And it was all about how to reduce alpha loops and endoscopy and all kinds of stuff. And I was like, ah, it's interesting. And then when I started my fellowship in 1997 with Pulenema Matsa, they said, okay, you're coming to SAGES with me. And that was my first SAGES meeting, 1997, San Diego, I believe. And it was mind-blowing. Every decision that I had ever made in my life led up to that moment of validation when I went to that SAGES meeting and I said, I have chosen the right career. I love this place. So it was a fantastic meeting and I was hooked ever. I've not missed a single SAGES meeting since 1997, with the exception of Las Vegas in
2021.
2021, the most recent
Yeah.
Vegas meeting,
Yeah.
when I was prohibited from traveling by my institution. So I gave a talk virtually, but I've
Oh,
attended.
we count that. You were still an attendee.
There you go.
Yeah.
I'll take it.
You miss a lot of COVID.
Yeah. It was actually not bad. But like you're working multiple other societies, you dove right into SAGES and then worked on many committees, have done a tour of the inner workings. And I know that many of your former and current committee members will be listening and they'll want to know which committee is your favorite committee by far.
Which committee is my favorite committee?
Yeah, what's your favorite
How
committee? I'm trying to
fair is
we're doing
that?
this is favorite things. So
I'm just
anybody
curious.
who's ever toured the Greek islands will tell you, see, don't you love the way I digress?
Yes,
Anybody
I
who's ever
yeah.
toured the Greek islands will tell you that there's no such thing as the Greek islands, that every island has its unique flavor.
There you go. Okay,
So I'm
perfect.
telling you, every committee that I have served on has had a completely different flavor. I will say that my most favorite committee, probably I would have to say, is the executive committee.
Yeah.
And the reasons for that is, first of all, you have the perspective of the full awe-inspiring and daunting scope of the society. It is really intimidating to sit in those executive meetings and hear about all of the things that SAGES members are doing. It's frightening, actually. And then, but the flip side of that is, it's such a close-knit, friendly group. The level of collegiality within SAGES leadership is, it is truly a family. It is truly amazing. So it is a pleasure to attend any SAGES committee meeting you ever want to, but the executive committee in particular, if you are accidentally placed on the executive like I have, it is such a privilege to be able to work with that group and see how committed everybody is to the mission.
It's all about the committees. Kevin, what kind of question are these? Pretty soon you're going to ask, who's your favorite SAGES Stories co-host?
I knew he'd take these well. That's why I threw them in there. I've seen him answer questions on the spot, so.
So Chris, I really like the Next Big Thing Innovation Weekend. I think this new arm of SAGES is awesome, fun. I mean, innovation is part of the whole thing, but it brings like such a awesome kind of group of scientists, innovators, entrepreneurs, surgeons, everyone together. You've been chair of the conference since 2020. I believe by the time we published this podcast, we had already passed that weekend. But maybe you can give us a little hint of what to expect at the Next Big Things Innovation Weekend by SAGES, the background, how did you even get it together, and how much support and interest was immediately there from industry and entrepreneurs and small.
So that's a great question, and I will try not to pepper my answer with literary references and my favorite movies. I think you have to go back about 5 years, maybe, when Jeff Marks was president. At the leadership retreat that year, they held a session called, I think they called it the Next Big Thing. It was one of their breakout groups, and that group was charged with trying to talk about, what is going to be the next big thing for SAGES? We've been talking about that for a while. And the mood at the time was that perhaps we had gotten away from being on the cutting edge of innovation and weren't seen anymore as the innovation society. And so they asked me if I would take on this responsibility, create this technology council and take on this responsibility of saying, how can we reestablish SAGES as being the go-to for leading edge
Yeah,
stuff?
it's huge.
the very last meeting that I attended before this little virus thing started spreading around the world was our first NBT weekend. But that wasn't the same as it is now. That was actually a retreat where we had, attendees from industry and surgeons and so on, and we had breakout groups. And the idea was to look at all aspects of what we do and what we should be doing. And we were looking at invention, and we were looking at supporting innovation, and we were looking at research and so on. And we came out of that NBT weekend with 13 actually actionable recommendations. We've got a shopping list. We still haven't quite finished all the shopping yet, but we're doing a really good job of working our way down the list. And one of the items that came out of that weekend was we should have a standalone meeting that is a smaller meeting, a much smaller meeting, that is specifically focused on really cutting-edge innovation and have industry partners come to that meeting and so on to really try to capture that thin edge of the wedge and the answer to the big picture about what is the next big thing is the next big thing is the whole next big thing process, right? To say we're not going to hang our coat on one operation, but we're now saying the next big thing is to actually be open and nimble and really focused on that leading edge. And that led to our saying, how do we plan this meeting going forward? And coincidentally, Eric Wilson had already established his Surgical Disruptive Technology Symposium in Houston. And he said, hey, I'm running this meeting that sounds exactly like what you're talking about. I would be happy to work with you guys on this. And so we have collaborated with Eric for the last 4 years. So the SDTS meeting is now a part of our Innovation Weekend. And then we said, let's use economy of scale to bring other innovation-related activities to that weekend. So NoScar was a group that I think that they were working on their identity and where their place going forward was going to be. And we said, why don't we offer the opportunity for NoScar to meet as a part of this weekend? And anybody who attended NBT even last year will see that the NoScar room was jam-packed. Like the attendance at NoScar is now back up to epic levels again, and as a part of being a part of this whole weekend, because the people that are interested in what's brand new are coming to this meeting now. And
And for the audience
industry
who may not
partners.
know, NoScar is an acronym for National Orifice Surgery Technology.
Yes.
Yeah.
National Orifice Surgical Consortium and Research, or something like that. I'm sorry to say, I'm going to be scolded for not getting that exactly right. But so NoScar, SDTS, we've then tacked on a bunch of other closed sessions like Oz Morales' brilliant work on the AI committee. He's done some segmentation and some data governance and so on. Amin Madani did a surgical data sciences retreat as a part of that. So, and our industry partners are really excited about this. And as much as we appreciate the support that we get from the big players, and they are a super valuable component, we're getting a lot of early phase companies, a lot of startups and stuff that are interested in being a part of
Yeah,
it. And
I've had.
that's the mission. And the idea would be to use this as the precursor to our annual meeting and say, look, we see something at SDTS or at the NBT Innovation Weekend, and we say, maybe we should be thinking about putting that on the podium for the main SAGES meeting in a year from now. We've coined this phrase too new for CME. So we want to be able to put stuff into the meeting that we say, look, you know what? It doesn't have to be endorsed by the society as what we think is the new standard. We want the SAGES meeting to be the meeting that people say, I've heard of this crazy new technology. Where can I go to hear more about it? Well, come to SAGES. You can come to NBT or you can come to the same main SAGES meeting, but we want to make sure we've always got that leading edge. We want to recapture that leading edge space.
Yeah, I want to piggyback off that, and you shared a great deal over the years about being a surgical entrepreneur. You've co-chaired sessions and done a lot of teaching on that. And we had Dr. Schweitzberg, Steven Schweitzberg, on recently and heard a little bit about Sages Ingenuity, which is the for-profit subsidiary of Sages. We'd love to hear your perspective on this relatively new initiative in Sages as well. I think it would be helpful to hear your thoughts on it.
Yeah, Sage's ingenuity, I think, is kind of it's one of those things that we're going to look back on it in 10 years and say, wow, I can't believe that we spent all that time and money on that. Or we're going to say, wow, I can't believe we ever functioned without it. It's going to go one way or the other. But this was by no means my invention. I think for years, people have been talking about, do we need some kind of a for-profit subsidiary of Sage's? Remember, Sage's is incorporated as a nonprofit. And any revenue that we generate, as long as it is directly related to the mission of Sage's education and so on, is acceptable for a nonprofit. But when we start talking about something like giving our members the opportunity to invest in surgical technologies and startups and generating revenue from that, that no longer really fits with the nonprofit. And were we to start generating significant revenue from those activities, which we hope we will, we needed to be able to say, we don't want to threaten the nonprofit status. So we had to incorporate a subsidiary. So Sage's Ingenuity is fully owned by Sage's. The board of Sage's Ingenuity is appointed by the Sage's board, but we handle all of the for-profit activities that would be considered unrelated taxable business income for Sage's, and it protects our tax-exempt status. And Sage's Ingenuity, the first thing that we're doing with Sage's Ingenuity has been the sink. And the idea of the sink, and we've done this, I mean, I have a recent mentor who introduced me to the long-standing phrase that you never, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. Like, surround yourself with good people. So one of the things I was asked to take over as a part of this whole innovation technology thing was to take over Shark Tank. And you've heard Steve talk about this. So
Love
I said,
Shark.
oh, I'm going to get Schweitzberg involved in this because, like, put the right people in the right job, but then you don't have to do any work yourself, right? So Steve brilliantly introduced us to this concept of getting Varia Ventures involved in this collaboration with Varia, this democratized investment vehicle for allowing Sage's members and their friends, and anybody listening to this podcast is officially a friend, to be able to invest in technology. So the idea was, you go to Shark Tank, you see somebody present at the Shark Tank, whether they win it or they're just a finalist, you say, that's a great idea. I want that in my operating room. How do I get a piece of that? How do I invest in that company? That's going to be
Absolutely.
big. And that's what we're offering through this. That's what we're offering through this collaboration with Varia. And that's the SINC, the Sage's Investment Network Collaborative. When the first iteration of that was the ability to invest directly in companies, but then that brought up concerns about conflict of interest and ownership in surgical technology and ACCME. And so we said, well, how about we make a fund where the investor doesn't decide exactly what company their money is going into? And that makes the whole process kosher as far as CME is concerned. So if you buy into the SINC fund, that presents no conflict of interest as far as your ability to participate in CME activities. But the SINC fund serves three purposes. One, it attracts innovators to Sage's, right? Part of that magnet. How do we get the cutting edge? Startup companies now can come to Sage's and say, how can we find some investment? How can we engage them in Shark Tank? Some of them want to just win the Shark Tank prize. Number two, when you invest in the sink, some of the revenue that's generated as these companies start to become profitable feeds back to Sage's and will help support Sage's activities. And number three, it's an opportunity for Sage's members to diversify their investment portfolio. And the highest return on investment is traditionally venture capital. So
No.
another service for Sage's members.
I love that we've spent most of this podcast as surgeons talking about entrepreneurship, innovation, technology, and not like actual, like physically doing the surgery. Love it. I love it. So if someone's listening and they also want to dive into innovation, investments, kind of that side of medicine, which is, I think, a very fascinating, very fun side, but also could be challenging because it's often not the language we learn to speak. So do you recommend they just plunge into it? Should they get an MBA? Kevin just got his MBA. I know, Chris, I think you're finishing up your MBA this year, right?
I am struggling through my MBA. Yes, you are correct.
Congratulations in advance. It's a lot of work.
Yeah, surprisingly so. Yes.
I was surprised too. I'm like, this is crazy. What did I
Drinking from a
just
fire
do?
hose. Drinking from a fire hose for
Yeah, what
sure.
did I just do?
I mean,
Yeah.
was it mostly math or is it a lot of like thought process changing how you think?
I mean, it's a lot of things. I've always been a math head, so I enjoyed the math stuff. I'm not. No, I think a lot of it is, I mean, having to write essays and so on again. But leadership training, I've always been a little bit contemptuous of people who try to tell me about, teaching leadership. But we had an outstanding individual who, the John Chilingarian, who started the program, unfortunately, the late John Chilingarian, was remarkable teacher and thought leader on leadership itself. And I've learned an enormous amount on how to approach leadership from this program. So, but yeah, there's, you got to put some effort into the work to earn a degree, right? So there's assignments. We'll get through it. Learning lots, though. Incredible. But no, you don't need to have an MBA to invest. You need to understand what venture capital is about. Anybody who's investing money should have a financial advisor. Right, don't take my word for it. But if you're interested in getting into that space, we try to offer sessions at the SAGES meeting. We've had entrepreneurism sessions, and this year, one of the new things we're doing on the surgical entrepreneur side is Dan Azaguri is going to be running a program on the early innovator. So, one of the criticisms with Shark Tank is for startups and companies where everybody's got their administration in place and they're an investable company. But what do you do for the person who's got an idea on the back of a dinner napkin? First of all, you have to pay for that napkin because times are tight and the restaurant needs their napkin back. But secondly, our hope would be that this session would be the kind of thing where you show up with your dinner napkin. We're going to try and see if we can develop a program to mentor individuals who have brilliant ideas into how can they actually turn that into a startup.
Wow, that's great. I think I'm going to go back and listen to Steve's portion about this and yours as well. It just really, I think, gives us a nice perspective of the other opportunities that SAGES offers outside of just clinical expertise. We are nearing the golden hour, knowing that you and I probably have early morning cases. Sharon is a little 3 hours behind us, so she's wide awake and about to
Oh
go to
yeah,
bed. But
I can go.
we should get some lighter answers from you, change the tune a little bit. So maybe tell us a little bit about your family.
Oh, my family are the best. They're so supportive of me. They put up with all my idiosyncrasies. We've been married for some time. I'm not allowed to disclose how long that is. My wife, Mary Lynn, has been a brilliant supporter and champion of mine since the beginning. She herself is very accomplished. She's a nurse, but she was a nurse practitioner and a nursing administrator and looking at very senior leadership roles within the hospital system at the time that we started our family. And she committed herself to raising our boys. And so we have two wonderful boys. I have a
Wow.
soon to be 18-year-old and a 20-year-old, one in university, one just finishing high school right now. Both of whom will change the world, I'm sure. And so, yeah, no, it's great family, great, great respite. Whenever you start to question your decisions in life, you just need to have dinner with your family, hug your boys. I have a thing with one of my boys that every time he gives me a hug, it adds years to my life. I got to tell you, it's amazing the fantastic comfort that I get from these meaningful hugs. I would recommend
Oh,
you
wow.
try that with all your children.
Do you have any pets?
We have a dog.
Oh, hugs from
Practice.
dogs are
It's
great
a
too.
practice pet. It's a Yorkie poo. Growing up, I had German shepherds and sheepdogs, and my wife wanted a dog that she could put in her purse. So I wanted a big dog. She wanted a little dog. So we compromised and got a little dog. But
Yorkies
he's
are great.
yeah,
Oh
he's cute.
yeah.
Not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but he's very cute.
Oh.
None of them are. They lack some function in the brain that they lack a neocortex. So that's going to make it hard. Well, we'd certainly be remiss not to not include our favorite segment. I'm sure you've been waiting for this, which is the We Are the Sages segment.
We are
And
the
in this one.
sages. Sing it, everybody.
We are the ones who make you brighter days. So let's start cheating.
Have you had a big hand.
One, we want to hear you describe your favorite Sages moment. Now, this could be at a national meeting. It could be any moment that comes to your head when you think of We Are the Sages segment.
Favorite Sages moment.
So I would love to regale you with how much fun it has been participating in the Canadian performance at the sing-off every year and the effort that goes into writing our song and everything. But I'm actually going to change my answer on that and say, when, because you asked me about what hooked me on Sages, about, I think it was about 2007 when Eubanks was president, Steve Eubanks, I got invited, I think I'm remembering this correctly, I got invited to my first Sages leadership retreat. I wasn't a board member, but I got invited to my first Sages leadership retreat. And at that retreat, if I remember correctly, that was the retreat where we did Beach Olympics. As a team building exercise, everybody who was invited to that retreat in South Beach, Miami, went to the beach. There were some very clear guidelines about appropriate attire, but we went to the beach and we had Beach Olympics and we were broken up into, I think, five or six teams. And we competed on the beach in ridiculous tasks. The most clever was you had to put on swim fins and a snorkel mask that was all dirty, and you had to race like a circuit on the beach. You can imagine how hard it is to run in the sand in your flippers and with your mask on.
Were there any injuries from that event?
No, I don't remember there being any injuries, but here's what was so great about that. It was, first of all, it was so much fun. And remember, one of our unofficial values for Sages is fun, right? We're a fun society.
Yes.
But what was really cool about that event and why it was so memorable for me was that we had past leaders, present leaders, and future leaders on a level playing field. There was no hierarchy. There were no stuffed shirts. I mean, I was playing tug of war with people that were icons of Lapras, like, oh my God, he spoke to me. He said hello, or, you know, I had no idea that she was even approachable and able to converse with ordinary people like myself. And it was just fantastic. And it was my first introduction to the idea that the Sages people were there for the intrinsic motivation. They were there for the fun of being at Sages and for the mission of Sages. And that's what was really, that was an incredible hook. It's experiences like that that make you say, I want to give more to this society, because it's such a great committed group of people. And so that was probably the thing that stands out the most in my mind.
Random question. What's the best book you've enjoyed reading? Non-medical.
Like in my lifetime, like my best favorite book ever?
Yeah, however you want to answer that.
Or
the
recently.
Life of Pi.
Which one?
Like all time, The Life of Pi was my favorite.
Oh, Life of Pi. Okay.
Brilliant
all
book. Right. I still make quotes about how important goodbyes are and Richard Parker running off into the woods and so on. So much you can extract from that story.
Yeah.
I'm reading two books right now at the same time, which makes no sense. Not MBA books. One of them is a revisionist history story about Oppenheimer, which is interesting. I started it before the movie came out, but it's a Canadian author who has written some of the best science fiction that I've ever read. And he's chosen to write an alternate history story about Oppenheimer and the development of the bomb, which is really clever. And the other one is an old Ray Bradbury book called The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, I think is the name of the book. And I picked that one up because I watched a Black Mirror episode and about some astronauts, and it was all dedicated to Ray Bradbury. And that was one of the books that was mentioned in that episode. And I said, oh yeah, I got to read that. And, you know, you can never go wrong reading Ray Bradbury. So.
Great. Well, on behalf of the Sages Stories team, I want to thank you for spending the past hour with us. I always love going back and listening to these after the finished product. And this is one I know I'm going to be bookmarking. Looking forward to seeing you in a couple months right here in Cleveland, Ohio, from April 17th to 20th for the Sages annual meeting. Everyone listening, make sure you register soon. The rooms in my house are filling up quickly, so don't want to miss out on those.
For those of you that don't remember, where does Kevin live?
Cleveland, Ohio.
I can't wait to see you there, Kevin.
Yeah, and just remember though, I do have dogs
and a cat.
Yeah, they're the entertainment.
And I can't wait to have dinner with you.
Perfect.
And I look forward to seeing you there, Chris. I always go to the Shark Tank session. It's one of my favorite, even though I get no CME for that, I think. I go anyway.
You guys are great. Thanks for having me. I love your podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for doing this. This has been great.
Thank you.
And that wraps up today's episode of Sage's Stories. You can view the show notes for any links to sites we referenced today. Visit sages.org for membership information and for the most recent news from our society. Follow us on Twitter at @sages_updates. Make sure you hit the like button and subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. See you again next time. And remember, you can't spell minimally invasive surgery without Sages.